Greetings, brothers and sisters, in the name of Jesus. It's a pleasure to be here. Some familiar faces, some not so familiar. Coming to Calvary brings back a flood of memories for me, all the way back to when this was a stage and this carpet was stored underneath, and we'd get here early and we'd roll out the carpet for church. How many remember being a part of that? It's only just a few. I was about a 10-year-old then. My dad was coming out here to help with some of the preaching and pastor work, I guess. And then fast forward a few years, I had my first date here and spent 2 years not visiting you all so much, but coming here for good reasons nonetheless. But time moves on, and time brings change. Is change good or bad? Is change from God or is it not? Well, God does ordain things in our lives, and for those who love Him, the changes can be and are for our good, and we're thankful to serve a faithful God and a good God who has our good in mind. I appreciated the service this morning, and I admit when I decided what to preach on, I had not looked at the Sunday school lesson yet, and I don't like negative services. The story of Ananias and Sapphira tends to be a little bit of a negative topic, right? It looks like a bad thing that happened in church life, but it ends up on a good note, right? It ends up with the church growing in God, blessing it. And so even the things that seem difficult at times can be for our good. Maybe before I introduce my topic, we're just going to read a little bit of scripture. Romans chapter 14. Let's read a few verses. We're not going to spend a lot of time here, but a few verses to help get our minds thinking down the lines the Lord has led me this morning. Romans 14, verse 10. But why dost thou judge thy brother? We live in a world that says, you can't judge. I can do what I want. Is that what this verse is saying? Let's read on. But why dost thou judge thy brother, or why dost thou set at naught thy brother? For we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. For it is written, as I live, saith the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God. So then every one of us shall give account of himself to God. Let us not therefore judge one another any more, but judge this rather, that no man put a stumbling block or an occasion to fall in his brother's way. I know and am persuaded by the Lord Jesus that there is nothing unclean of itself, but to him that esteemeth anything to be unclean, to him it is unclean. But if thy brother be grieved with thy meat, now walkest thou not charitably. Destroy not him with thy meat, for whom Christ died. Now this chapter is talking particularly to the weaker brother, saying, if there's somebody weak, and you know you can eat meat, but he thinks he can't eat meat, then don't do it for your brother's good. Let not then your good be evil spoken of, for the kingdom of God is not meat and drink, but righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Ghost. For he that in these things serveth Christ is acceptable to God and approved of men. Now, we're not going to talk about the weaker brother. We're not going to talk about things lawful necessarily. But I do want to think about this concept that the writer here introduces about judging each other and this trap that we tend to fall into sometimes. The founder of FedEx, his name was Fred Smith. He's quoted to have said this, no one ever erected a statue to a critic. Think about people who are highly esteemed. He said no one ever did one for a critic. Ben Franklin said it's easy for any fool to criticize, condemn, and complain. And most fools do. That's what foolish people do. They criticize, condemn, and complain. I want you to ask yourself this morning, do you criticize and pass judgment on others? Do you find yourself with a negative disposition, always finding fault with something or someone? Is it difficult for you to see the good in somebody else, to see the positive in a person or a situation, because the negative is just so glaring in your eye? You just can't see past that negativity. Are you compelled to give your critical point of view for the good of all mankind? Sure hope everyone's listening, because, yeah. Can I still love a brother or a sister who shares a concern with me? I'm flipping the script a little there. What about if it's coming this way? I want to look at both directions this morning. Whether I want us to examine our own hearts for this spirit of criticism or being critical of others, being negative. And I also want to think some about what happens when someone does see something in my life and they say, hey, what about this? How are you going to respond to that? See, life requires a lot of grace. It really does. And there's so much that we assume. We think we see the whole picture, but we assume so much about so many people in so many situations. Maybe it's mostly right. But if we have this negative personality or negative thought processes that tend to run down the same tracks in our mind, then when we view these situations and our minds need to fill in some of the blanks because we don't have all the details, then we start going to the negative. We say, well, probably this and probably that, right? And so we're going to come around. We're going to talk about criticism first, but I'm going to tell you now, because we're going to get there before too long, but I believe that bitterness is at the root of criticism. I think that the criticism is the fruit that grows above the ground that we can see and that we can hear, but what's beneath that is almost always bitterness. But what's bitterness? What's bitterness? I'm going to write up a definition for you this morning that I want you to remember. Bitterness is the unresolved violation of my justice system. We're going to come back to that after a while. We're going to talk first, divide the messages into three parts. We're going to talk about criticism and four different ways that it tends to be shown in our lives. And then we're going to look at Jesus' teaching on a critical spirit. But then we want to come back to bitterness and say, what is the cause and what is the cure for bitterness? So I'm making that, and you can argue with me after church if you wish, but I'm making that claim. So we think about bitterness, as we think about critical spirit, I believe that's what lies at the root. The sermon title this morning is Overcoming a Critical Spirit. Now, I know my tendency to go long, so some of these verses I'm just going to read for you to save a little bit of time, but jot them down on your notes, and you may look them up later and verify that they are true. 1 Timothy 5:13 says that we're going to look at four types of critical spirits. And withal, they learn to be idle, wandering from house to house, not only idle, but tattlers also and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. That's from 1 Timothy 5:13. The first type of a critical spirit, or where excessive criticism shows up, is in gossiping. What is a gossiper? I think we know quite well, don't we? Gossiper is someone who, well, the Bible uses the term talebearer, one who reveals secrets, goes about as a talebearer, whether they are, often the thoughts that are shared are either private, it's things that are confidential, or else they're very judgmental of a situation or of a person. That's what tends to define gossip apart from normal conversation. We talk about all kinds of things after church, right? When we go to Sunday lunch, we sit down and we visit, and it's good that we talk about our lives, and we talk about other people too. But when it turns toward judgmentalism or things that are of a private nature that violates people's privacy, then we've got a problem. A gossiper tends to present himself as having privileged information about somebody that other people don't have. I hope this isn't gossip, but did you hear? Did you hear that so-and-so is attending another church? Did you hear about that? Some people just feel, it seems like they get their value or their satisfaction from life from being able to be the first one to share news. You know people like that? They just have to be the one who has this wealth of knowledge, this vast bank of information, and not only are they the first to say it, but they have the answer to all the problems too. Well, that's a gossiper. A slanderer, number two. Proverbs 10:18, he that hideth hatred with lying lips, and he that uttereth a slander is a fool. A slanderer is a person who makes false statements in order to damage a person's reputation. So intentionally, just twisting that truth to the point that it's not even, that it's a lie, right? It's not true. It's slander. It's casting a slant on the situation that we know is beyond what is true. Slanderers don't care about the truth. They don't care about correcting an error. And he intends to inflict harm on a person. A complainer, number three. James 5:9, grudge not or murmur not one against another, brethren, lest ye be condemned. Behold, the judge standeth before the door. A complainer is a person who is habitually negative about others and about circumstances. So now we're talking just this negative drag on life. Everything he sees is through, well, they're not rose-tinted glasses. What color are they? He just sees life with a negative personality. Everyone's against him. He sees a devil behind every bush. I remember a man who used to come to our church, and if he couldn't start his lawnmower, it was the devil. You know, it was just, maybe it was just an old lawnmower. But just the negative, and he wasn't always that way. Do all things without murmurings and disputing, Paul says in Philippians 2:4. Do all things without murmuring. Just learn not to take that negative, complaining attitude. We could go back and see how God felt about complaining in the book of Exodus and how he dealt with that. And the fourth one is judgmentalism. And that's kind of what Romans 14 was talking about here. We have the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus talked about being judgmental. Jesus addresses this judgmentalism and having a critical spirit. And we want to read about that. Let's read Jesus' words. Let's turn to this one, Matthew chapter 7. We're going to spend a little time on this one. Let's read the first five verses of Matthew 7. Judge not that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye mete, it shall be measured to you again. And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Maybe we should reread that. Why beholdest thou the splinter or the speck or the piece of dust in your brother's eye while you have a 2x4 stuck in your own eye? Okay, that's what he's saying. You have this giant problem, but all you can see is the little speck over here. Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye. A judgmental person has this exclusively critical point of view, a tendency to judge very harshly in situations. Typically, they don't have this heart of compassion. They don't have empathy. They don't have a concern for how this is going to sound to others or how this person's going to feel. They just say, you know what? This is the truth, and this is how it needs to be dealt with. And they believe they have the ability to do it. And they have the ability to know the motives, not only exactly what they did, but they know why they did it too, right? This is an amazing skill that some people have, being able to point out other people's mistakes and somehow just minimize their own. God help us. Jesus says a number of things here dealing with this. The first one, I think, as we, what does Jesus teach about overcoming a critical spirit? The first thing is that you need to choose not to be a condemning critic. It's your choice. He says, this is Jesus' words, he said, don't judge. Okay, that's how he starts out. Judge not. He says you need to stop. This is something that you and I need to choose. We need to evaluate our lives and the situations we're in, and we say, okay, wait a minute. How do we relate to this situation? Well, what judgment is Jesus talking about? We know Jesus is not, as we read the rest of his teachings, we know he's not saying, don't call out false teachers. Because he says, you need to know what the truth is, right? He's not saying, it doesn't matter, or you can't, if there's sin in the church, well, that's just leaven and you have to let it go. No, he's saying you do need to deal with sin. Look at the book of Acts that we looked at this morning, right? Does God care about dealing with sin? Does God care about bringing sin to justice? Of course God does. And he even calls us to try the spirits. And that takes some testing and some discernment. There is that part of it. But I think what he's saying, again, not, you can't take a stand for moral truth or for absolute truth. That's what we hear in today's culture. You can have any lifestyle you want, and you can't call me out for it, right? That's not what Jesus is saying. He used the word here for judge not was the Greek word krino. Krino, which is actually where we get our English word critic. Don't be critical is really what he's saying. And that word means to try or to condemn or to punish or to damn. And really what it's saying is when we try people in the courtroom of our own mind, it's when situations come up and people do this and people do that, in our mind we like set them up in front of us and we say, okay, she's right, but she's definitely wrong. He got this so wrong, but he did the right thing, okay? And in our mind, we're like trying to figure out everyone. Jesus said, don't do that. This is the sin that Jesus is prohibiting, being consumed with criticism, fault-finding, having a heart that magnifies the problem. That's typically what happens. We start setting them up in our minds in this courtroom, and the problem gets bigger and bigger. It's something that I think forms pathways in our brains. It's thought processes that become habitual, and we just tend to, if we have a critical spirit, we tend to just habitually condemn and find fault, dwell on others' faults, constantly tell others how to do it better. Where does this show up? Well, it shows up in marriages sometimes. Sometimes there's spouses who need to set the record straight on everything that their spouse does. I see that sometimes in marriages. And it's little things. Somehow, in our marriages, the Bible says love needs to cover the multitude of sins. We're not talking about brushing sin under the carpet that needs to be dealt with, but there are idiosyncrasies and things that your spouse will do, and your spouse too, that we just need to say, hey, it's okay. I love her anyhow. It's fine. It happens, though. Husbands and wives can actually develop that. And that is the worst. And children who grow up in homes like that feel like they have no chance. It happens in churches. Church members, where there's plenty of positive things that could be talked about in congregational life. But instead, we just keep talking about that stuff that happened that we just can't lay to rest. We just keep bringing it up. We jump on people and we criticize and we condemn them. It's one of the most damaging things that can happen in a church, I think. I think there's a number of reasons why people become critical like this. I think people really believe, maybe they don't say it out loud, but they believe that if they can keep the spotlight on somebody else's flaws, it's going to keep the spotlight off of mine. And maybe people just won't look at me so bad if I'm constantly sending them over there to look at that person, right? And I think it even makes us feel good about ourselves sometimes. If we can say, this person just struggles here and they've missed the mark here. And wait, did we hear about that in devotions this morning? God, I thank you that I'm not like, right? That's exactly what he was doing. I think we tend to be critical of our peers and those who work in the same field that we do. I think that mothers tend to criticize mothers. How they raise their children or how they keep their house or don't keep their house. Business owners tend to criticize business owners. Pastors tend to criticize pastors. It's what we tend to do. Because, again, it kind of makes us feel good if we can make one of our peers go down a notch, right? Oh, God help us. Charles Darwin was not a godly man. And he had a very critical spirit. The story is told of him going to a restaurant, and the spot that they were sitting was too cold. The service was too slow. The salad had too much dressing. The meat was overcooked, and just everything was wrong. And the manager finally came out and said, I'm really sorry that we weren't able to satisfy you today. And his wife chimed in and said, oh, no, you don't need to apologize. He was very happy that he could find fault with everything here tonight. That's just what he lived for. I hope that can't be said of us. Why else, or what else was Jesus teaching here in these first five verses of chapter 7? I think another thing he was teaching is that we need to render judgment on others the way that we want judgment rendered on us. We see that in verse 2. He says, for the judgment that you judge with is the same judgment that you are going to receive. And he highlights this law of, now this is a big word, reciprocity. We'll break it down for the men. It's a reciprocal saw, right? This law of back and forth. Jesus said, the way you treat others is the way you're going to be treated. The way you judge others is the way you're going to be judged. Now, I don't know if that's sobering to you or not, but I want you to picture standing before God someday. Do you want God to mete out mercy or justice? I know what you want. The question is, have I been meting out mercy or justice? Because I believe from Jesus' words that he is going to judge us the way, he's going to judge me the way I judged my wife, my church family, my boss. It really does matter. And the tendency is to judge myself by my intentions and to judge others by their actions, right? But I had good intentions. I didn't mean for it to come out that way. I didn't mean for it to look that way. Well, the good news is that when we receive Jesus as our Savior, we can, and when we allow him to be Lord of our life, we can stand before God someday, and we can claim mercy if we've been people of mercy. The truth is that if we really understand the grace of God and the mercy that we received at Calvary, then we will be men and women that show mercy and kindness and compassion with those around us. The third thing yet that Jesus was teaching here, I believe, is that we need to respond humbly to criticism and be a wise admonisher. We see that in verse 5. He's not saying you can't go talk to your brother about that speck in your eye, but he's saying you do need to get that 2x4 out of your eye first, right? And then go talk to them. So he's not saying you can't talk to other people, right? You do need to go and talk to other people. You need to give constructive criticism, and you need to, well, if someone needs to give it, then somebody needs to receive it, right? If Jesus says you have to talk constructively to other people, then that means at some point you're going to be the one that needs to receive it too. And there are, God places people in our lives for that very purpose. When we need it, what are we going to do? I want to give you a couple of things that differentiates constructive criticism from judgmentalism and criticism. Constructive criticism always goes to the source, goes to the person, deals with the problem at hand.
It's so easy to build your case. You can start rounding up all kinds of negative things that don't even hardly apply to the situation, and you go to all these other people first, right? Constructive criticism always goes to the brother and say, you know what? I saw this in your vernon. I want to talk to you about it. Okay? And you talk about the situation that you actually saw. Constructive criticism always goes in love and speaks the truth in love. And constructive criticism always offers a solution. You don't put someone at arm's length and say, I saw this in your life. I'm going to walk out of your life and we're not going to talk about it again. You say, I want to walk through. What can I do to help you through this? Is it something you're struggling with? Always offers a solution. Now, the cause and the cure of a critical spirit. I told you already that I believe that it's bitterness, and maybe it's more than that. We're going to specifically highlight bitterness, but it's our own sinful flesh. It's this stuff inside that we don't always get crucified like we should. It's this idea where we live with little or no grace, where we hold people to this harsh line. Maybe it's our nature to be a pessimist or to have negativity. But we can overcome that. Maybe it's insecurity. I see people who are very insecure that become critical of people as a way to try to reach out. Maybe it's just immaturity. Maybe it's an unrenewed mind. Maybe it's bad company and a bad environment. Whatever it is, I still think that most of the time, if you trace that back to the roots, there's something inside. There is some justice. I'm going to explain why I believe this. There's some justice that's been unresolved. Sorry, is the word I wanted. There's something in your life where you say, but it's just not fair. And what I see is people who go through difficult times where they have a difficult cross to bear sometimes. And through that, they just become negative. They don't quite accept that this is what God has for me. It's got to be, why would I be asked to give up a spouse? Or why would I be asked to, you fill in the blank. Bitterness, the unresolved violation of your justice system. Now, we're going to talk about the cause and the cure, but I'm going to take it backwards. I'm going to tell you the cure first, and then I'm going to tell you what I think the cause is. I want you to go back to the very first reference in the Bible to where the word bitter shows up, and that is in Exodus 15. I think that when we go to the first place that doctrinal things and practical things show up, they often have a special meaning there, and I think this is no exception. This is the story of where Israel was just delivered from slavery. God had miraculously destroyed their enemies in front of them, drowned them in the Red Sea, proved that he was God, proved that he was capable of providing for their needs, proved that he was capable of protecting them, leading them through the wilderness. And here you come, just shortly after, and they have a problem. They have no water. Verse 22 of Exodus 15. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, which means bitter, and you can read it that way, when they came to bitter, they could not drink of the waters of bitter, or of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? And he cried unto the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, which when he had cast into the waters were made sweet. There he made for them a statue and an ordinance, and there he proved them. And said, if thou wilt diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God, and wilt do that which is right in his sight, and wilt give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon thee, which I have brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord that healeth thee. And he gives them a promise. Just trust me. Just trust me enough, and I'll show you that I can. What was happening here? I think that it was bitterness. I think that it was an injustice. They said, here we were following you, God. We were doing what you asked us to do. We trusted you enough to walk across that Red Sea. We even wrote a song for you and we sang it and we praised you when it was all over. And now you won't give us water? You're taking water away from us? When you're capable of giving us water, you give us water that's bitter. That's what they were angry at. They said, this isn't fair. We're doing the things that you asked us to do. We're walking the path you asked us to go on. And you give us bitter water? I don't know what you would say is the strongest emotion. A lot of people would say love is the strongest emotion, and that may be true. But I think it might be justice, or at least it's a close runner-up. Almost everything in our lives is filtered through this system of justice. We say, oh, but I don't deserve that, or that's really not fair, so I'm gonna choose this, or we evaluate other people's lives and, well, it's not fair that they were able to afford a new van, or it's not fair that they were able, look at the nice house they moved. They probably shouldn't have spent that much money because, I mean, I could. Okay, and we run almost all these scenarios are running, you know, our system of what's fair and what's not, and making sure they don't get more than I get and that everyone gets what they deserve. But fairness is subjective. Justice is eternal. See, fairness is me looking through my little glasses at what I can see is right at the moment and saying, but that's not fair because I see this, right? Justice is, I want you to just picture the God of the universe who sees everything and he's bringing about good and he takes someone through this path, whereas he takes this family through this path. And it's not going to look fair, but justice is an eternal perspective that God has and that God can do and that God can mete out. God knows what he's doing. Think of the life of Job. Job could have said all day long, life isn't fair. But he said, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He understood the justice of God. And even though he said, I don't know what's happening, I don't understand it, I'm going to choose to trust you, God. And I'm not going to curse you. So the first problem is our perspective. And the second problem is our depravity, or just this natural, well, our human nature. And this justice gets filtered through our own not only limited perspective, but also our sinful nature and our pride and our selfishness. And then if we can't resolve it, then we get bitter. It's not fair, here we have. It's not fair that God would let us in the wilderness without water. But God said, murmuring is doubting me, and I need to punish murmuring. We doubt when we think God is doing something that isn't right, and it violates what in our mind should be justice. And so what did God do? He showed Moses a tree. The tree, all through the Old Testament, is a type of the cross. He showed him a tree, and I believe with all my heart that this story is pointing forward to the injustice that happened on a tree. When Jesus was nailed to the tree, we got the good deal. It was a bad deal for Jesus, if you want to say it that way. It was so unjust. It wasn't fair. He was perfect. He was sinless. You and I were the sinners. And he hung there and gave his life for me and for you. Is that fair? Of course it's not. But it satisfied the justice of God. And I think what's happening is God in this story is saying, listen, if in your life you're struggling to understand why life doesn't seem fair, go to the cross. Go to the cross. And when you see Jesus hanging on that tree, if you really believe it and embrace it and accept it, then nothing that God brings into your life and my life is really injustice anymore. Nothing can be worse than a perfect Son of God dying on my behalf. Okay? Nothing that somebody can do to me is worse than that. Now, maybe that sounds too trite to you, but I do want you to think about that. Maybe there's something that happened years ago. Maybe there's a tragedy that just seemed so wrong. Maybe it's somebody that someone took out of your life. Maybe it's a church scenario. I see so many people here from so many different churches. When we change churches and when things like that happen, it is a prime time for the devil to plant seeds of injustice and say, what he said to me wasn't fair, so I'm leaving. Or what she, the way that church treated me, the way, okay, and we can go down all these scenarios. I want you to go back. Think about it. Maybe it's something that happened 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago. We're going to look at the story yet, and I'll do it quickly. We're going to look at the story of an old man who went to his grave bitter because there was injustices in his life that he never resolved. And we can do the same thing. We can go to our graves as bitter, critical people if we don't find healing at the waters where the tree is and where Christ gave his life to take away this injustice. I need to hurry on. Let's turn to the story of this older man. Maybe you know. Who is Ahithophel? How many people know who Ahithophel is? Have you read about Ahithophel in the Bible? There's a couple of hands. I'm sure you've heard the name, haven't you, at least? Be interesting to actually see if you could figure out who he is. I want to take you on a quick journey, and I want to show you who Ahithophel is, and maybe when we get to the end, you'll understand a little bit more about what bitterness does to a man and why it's so important that we find the cure. So the cure is the cross, but the cause, what's the cause? Again, I'm saying the cause is a violation of our justice system that's never been resolved. Turn to 2 Samuel 15. I'm going to take you through the story. I want you to follow along. We're basically just going to be looking at this story, probably not a lot of notes to take here, so follow with me. This is a story of when David is king, and he's about to lose the kingdom to his own son. Talk about an injustice. Your own son rises up against you and says to the people, hey, come follow me. Your dad isn't doing such a good job. Why don't you come listen to me, right? He's tall, he's dark, he's handsome, but he has a bitter heart. And we know why, too. There was an unresolved violation of his justice system. It was when his sister Tamar was raped and his dad never took care of it. And Absalom goes on to live with bitterness over that situation. And he's like, I'm going to get back at dad. And he forms a conspiracy. Let's read the start, verses 10 and 12. We're not going to read a lot of verses. We're going to jump through the story. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigneth in Hebron. And when Absalom went, and with Absalom went 200 men out of Jerusalem that were called, and they went in their simplicity, and they knew not anything. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor. Well, this is David's counselor. Start making a little mental list of who this man is. From his city, even from Gilo, while he offered sacrifices. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. So what's going on? Absalom is in a conspiracy against his dad, and he takes his dad's counselor, right? Is that what it says? Yeah, that's what it says. Why would he pick his dad's counselor to join the conspiracy? I think he knew something about this man. Did you ever hear the term birds of a feather flock together? Absalom was what? Bitter. What do you think Ahithophel was? I'm telling you now, he was a bitter man. I'm going to show you that he was, and I'm going to show you why he was. He picks this bitter man, and he takes him onto his camp, onto his side. But why is Ahithophel bitter, and who is he? Let's go down to verse 31, still in chapter 15. And one told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. David, your own man, went across. And David said, O Lord, I pray thee, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. He knew that Ahithophel was a good counselor, and he could convince people. And he said, Lord, can you be merciful here? And it came to pass that when David was come to the top of the mount where he worshipped God, behold, Hushai, the Archite, came to meet him with his coat rent and earth upon his head, unto whom David said, if thou passest on with me, then thou shalt be a burden unto me. But if thou return to the city and say unto Absalom, I will be thy servant, O king, as I have been thy father's servant hitherto, so will I now also be thy servant. Then mayest thou for me defeat the counsel of Ahithophel.
Do you understand what he's saying? Here comes Hushai. He's running. He has dirt on his head. His clothing's torn. He runs up to David. And he said, David. David said, wait. I'm glad you came to support me. But what I really want you to do is I want you to go pretend. I guess this is okay. Go pretend you're on the other side. Get in on Absalom's crew. And I want you to listen for what Ahithophel says. And you say the other thing, because Ahithophel's smart, and what he says is going to bring us down, but maybe you can defeat the counsel of him. So go see what you can do. See what's going on here? And so Hushai goes. Let's jump down to chapter 16, verse 20. But who is this man again, and why is he bitter? Then said Absalom to Ahithophel, give counsel among you what we shall do. And Ahithophel said unto Absalom, This is the story. Let me just explain a little bit. Again, David has left the city, and Absalom is like, okay, here we are. We have the city. What are we going to do? And as a bitter man, he's thinking, what can I do to just get back at my dad? He's bitter at his dad, right? And he goes to Ahithophel, another bitter man. He says, what can we do? And this is almost too awful to read. But he says, go in unto thy father's concubines, which he hath left to keep the house, and all Israel shall hear that thou art a port of thy father. Then shall the hands of all that are with thee be strong. So they spread Absalom a tent upon the top of the house, and Absalom went in unto his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. And the counsel of Ahithophel, which he counseled in those days, was as if a man had inquired at the oracle of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom. I believe Absalom went back to that story of what David had done on the rooftop. That was a violation of justice. It was. It was a violation to Bathsheba. It was a violation to her husband, Uriah the Hittite, right? It was a violation of the justice system of the children of Israel. They deserved a king that was better than that. And this bitter man said, you know what? That's what my dad did. Look what I'm going to do. And it's awful. But this man was like a preacher. It said when he spoke, when Ahithophel spoke, even though he was a bitter man and he had this horrible idea in his heart, he still was someone that people listened to like, that's like God speaking. You think preachers can live with bitterness in here? They can. I'm telling you, they can. Go to chapter 17. Who is this man and why? Why did Ahithophel say to do that? Why was he so bitter? I think it's going to make sense shortly. 2 Samuel 17, verse 1 to 3. Moreover, Ahithophel said unto Absalom, let me now choose out 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue after David this night, and I will come upon him while he is weary and weak-handed, and will make him afraid, and all the people that are with him shall flee. And I will smite the king only, and I will bring back all the people unto thee. The man whom thou seekest is as if all returned. So all the people shall be in peace. And Ahithophel says, as a bitter man, he says, I'll go take David out myself. Just let me do it. I'll go do it. Verse 6, and when Hushai was come to Absalom, Absalom spake unto him. Remember who Hushai is? He's now apparently successfully integrated into David's team as a hidden operative, right? He's working a detective behind the scenes. When Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom spake unto him, saying, Ahithophel hath spoken after this manner. What was the manner? Ahithophel was going to go with thousands of men, but he was just going to take out David himself. Ahithophel hath spoken after this manner. Shall we do after his saying? If not, speak thou. And here they come to Hushai. What do you think, Hushai? Well, Hushai said, let's go down to verse 14. Well, Hushai said, no, that's not good. We're not going to take the time to read all that. It's in between there. He says, I don't think you should do that. You should do this instead. Look at verse 14. And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord hath appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring evil upon Absalom. Suddenly the people flipped and they said, oh, Hushai's right. If we go the way that
Ahithophel suggested, probably, see, David is a angry man right now. They're vexed. They just were kicked out of their city. They're going to be like, maybe still adrenaline rush, right? And he says, you shouldn't do that. And they said, you're right. Ahithophel's counsel probably would have ended this. We would have all gotten killed by David's men. Good for you, Hushai. Let's listen to Hushai instead. Look at verse 23. And when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass and arose and got him home to his house, to his city, and put his household in order and hanged himself and died and was buried in the sepulcher of his father. He was that bitter. It was so wrong in his mind, so unjust that someone would listen to Hushai instead of him, because when I speak, it says of the oracles of God, he says, right? You know what? I'm just going to end it all, he said. I really believe, and I'm not a psychologist, but I think that most suicides are a result of this right here, bitterness and an unresolved violation of the justice system. A person gets to a point where they say, it's never going to be right. There's no way to make life right again. And it's an act of selfishness, I suppose. I don't know. But why? We still don't know why. Why was this old man so bitter to the point that he took his own life? His own life. Well, we're almost there. Chapter 23. We got to go forward a few pages to verse 34. This is the list, a catalog of David's mighty men. Look what it says. Eliphelet, the son of Ahasbai, the son of Manachathite, Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, the Gilonite. Now, this still doesn't really tell who he is, except that he has a son who's one of David's mighty men. Apparently his son, and let me tell you, if you have a bitter father, you can be like Eliam and say, I'm not going to walk in the bitterness of my father. I'm going to be one of David's mighty men. I'm going to support the king. I'm going to support the church, even though my father didn't. It's possible for you to do that. Eliam was one of David's men, and yet still we have Ahithophel being bitter at David. But why? I got one more verse for you, and I think this will answer it. Back to chapter 11 and verse 3. 2 Samuel 11, 3. And David sent and inquired after the woman, and one said, is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, who was the son of Ahithophel, right? Bathsheba was the granddaughter of Ahithophel. Ahithophel was Bathsheba's grandpa. And what David did to his granddaughter never got resolved. It was too much. It crossed the line in his mind, as I understand this story. He said, I will never forgive that man for what he did to my granddaughter. And what David did was wrong. Don't get me wrong. Things happen in life that are just plain wrong. Injustices happen because we live in a broken world that's broken because men choose sin and they choose lust and they choose to follow their own flesh. What David did to Bathsheba was wrong. It violated her justice, Uriah's justice, Grandpa's justice, and David deserved to be judged. And Ahithophel said, I'll never forgive him. And it took him to his grave. I want you to think about that this morning. If there's bitterness in your heart, if there's something that's happened way back there that you just say, I will never forgive that person. I just won't talk to them. I won't go to church with them again. I won't, whatever it is. It's going to take you to your grave. It will. There is healing at the cross. At the cross, there is a beautiful picture, as we said before, of Jesus choosing to walk the path of injustice, choosing because he loved. allowed love to overcome that desire for justice, allowed God, allowed justice to stay in the hands of an almighty God who could make everything right someday. What does Romans say? Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. That's the problem that we have when we hang on to this bitterness in our hearts. I think it's almost always, it's my way of being able to get back and try to make this injustice right. If I can make them miserable, you know what it is. It's drinking your own poison, right? You don't need to carry bitterness any longer. Bitter things can be made sweet at the cross. A critical spirit is very damaging. So is bitterness. And I think bitterness is what drives many people to a life of criticism and just looking down on other people with a negative attitude. Because something in here never was taken care of. I just want to call us again today. Come to the cross. Find freedom. Find forgiveness. Find healing from bitterness and from injustice at the cross of Christ, where Jesus died for you and for me. Let's kneel for prayer.